This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information, and to find out how you can volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Recorded by Nicole Doolin on the web at NicoleDoolin.com. Moll Flanders by Daniel Defoe. Section 14. While I was there, and before I was brought to bed, I received a letter from my trustee at the bank, full of kind, obliging things, and earnestly pressing me to return to London. It was near a fortnight old when it came to me, because it had been first sent into Lancashire, and then returned to me. He concludes with telling me that he had obtained a decree, I think he called it, against his wife, and that he would be ready to make good his engagement to me, if I would accept of him, adding a great many protestations of kindness and affection, such as he would have been far from offering if he had known the circumstances I had been in, and which, as it was, I had been very far from deserving. I returned an answer to his letter, and dated it at Liverpool, but sent it by messenger, alleging that it came in cover to a friend in town. I gave him joy of his deliverance, but raised some scruples at the lawfulness of his marrying again, and told him I supposed he would consider very seriously upon that point before he resolved on it, the consequence being too great for a man of his judgment to venture rashly upon a thing of that nature. So concluded, wishing him very well in whatever he resolved, without letting him into anything of my own mind, or giving any answer to his proposal of my coming to London to him, but mentioned at a distance my intention to return the latter end of the year, this being dated in April. I was brought to bed about the middle of May, and had another brave boy, and myself in as good condition as usual on such occasions. My governess did her part as a midwife with the greatest art and dexterity imaginable, and far beyond all that ever I had had any experience of before. Her care of me in my travail, and after in my lying in, was such that if she had been my own mother, it could not have been better. Let none be encouraged in their loose practices from this dexterous lady's management, for she is gone to her place, and I dare say has left nothing behind her that can or will come up on it. I think I had been brought to bed about 22 days when I received another letter from my friend at the bank, with the surprising news that he had obtained a final sentence of divorce against his wife, and had served her with it on such a day, and that he had such an answer to give to all my scruples about his marrying again, as I could not expect, and as he had no desire of, for that his wife, who had been under some remorse before for her usage of him, as soon as she had the account that he had gained his point, had very unhappily destroyed herself that same evening. He expressed himself very handsomely as to his being concerned at her disaster, but cleared himself of having any hand in it, and that he had only done himself justice in a case in which he was notoriously injured and abused. However, he said that he was extremely afflicted at it, and had no view of any satisfaction left in his world, but only in the hope that I would come and relieve him by my company. And then he pressed me violently indeed to give him some hopes that I would at least come up to town and let him see me, when he would further enter into discourse about it. I was exceedingly surprised at the news, and began now seriously to reflect on my present circumstances, and the inexpressible misfortune it was to me to have a child upon my hands, and what to do in it I knew not. At last I opened my case at a distance to my governess. I appeared melancholy and uneasy for several days, and she lay at me continually to know what troubled me, I could not for my life tell her that I had an offer of marriage, after I had so often told her that I had a husband, so that I really knew not what to say to her. I owned I had something which very much troubled me, but at the same time told her I could not speak of it to any one alive. She continued importuning me for several days, but it was impossible, I told her, for me to commit the secret to anybody. This, instead of being an answer to her, increased her importunities. She urged her having been trusted with the greatest secrets of this nature, that it was her business to conceal everything, and that to discover things of that nature would be her ruin. She asked me if ever I had found her tattling to me of other people's affairs, and how could I suspect her? She told me to unfold myself to her was telling it to nobody, that she was silent as death, that it must be a very strange case indeed that she could not help me out of, but to conceal it was to deprive myself of all possible help, or means of help, and to deprive her of the opportunity of serving me. In short, she had such a bewitching eloquence, and so great a power of persuasion, that there was no concealing anything from her. So I resolved to unbosom myself to her. I told her the history of my Lancashire marriage, and how both of us had been disappointed, how we came together and how we parted, how he absolutely discharged me, as far as lay in him, free liberty to marry again, protesting that if he knew it, he would never claim me, or disturb or expose me, that I thought I was free, but was dreadfully afraid to venture, for fear of the consequences that might follow in case of a discovery. Then I told her what a good offer I had, showed her my friend's two last letters, inviting me to come to London, and let her see with what affection and earnestness they were written, but blotted out the name, and also the story about the disaster of his wife, only that she was dead. She fell a-laughing at my scruples about marrying, and told me the other was no marriage, but a cheat on both sides, and that as we were parted by mutual consent, the nature of the contract was destroyed, and the obligation was mutually discharged. She had arguments for this at the tip of her tongue, and, in short, reasoned me out of my reason, not but that it was too by the help of my own inclination. But then came the great and main difficulty, and that was the child. This, she told me in so many words, must be removed, and that so as that it should never be possible for any one to discover it. I knew there was no marrying without entirely concealing that I had had a child, for he would soon have discovered by the age of it that it was born. Nay, and gotten too, since my parley with him, and that would have destroyed all the affair. But it touched my heart so forcibly to think of parting entirely with the child, and, for aught I knew, of having it murdered or starved by neglect and ill usage, which was much the same, that I could not think of it without horror. I wish all those women who consent to the disposing of their children out of the way, as it is called, for decency's sake, would consider that 'tis only a contrived method for murder, that is to say, a killing their children with safety. It is manifest to all that understand anything of children, that we are born into the world helpless, and incapable either to supply our own wants, or so much as to make them known, and that without help we must perish, and that this help requires not only an assisting hand, whether of the mother or somebody else, but there are two things necessary in that assisting hand, that is, care and skill, without both which, half the children that are born would die, nay, though they were not to be denied food, and one half more of those that remained would be cripples or fools, lose their limbs, and perhaps their sense. I question not but that these are partly the reasons why affection was placed by nature in the hearts of mothers to their children, without which they would never be able to give themselves up, as 'tis necessary they should, to the care and waking pains needful to the support of their children. Since this care is needful to the life of children, to neglect them is to murder them. Again, to give them up to be managed by those people who have none of that needful affection placed by nature in them, is to neglect them in the highest degree. Nay, in some it goes farther, and is a neglect in order to their being lost, so that 'tis even an intentional murder, whether the child lives or dies. All those things represented themselves to my view, and that is the blackest and most frightful form. And as I was very free with my governess, whom I had now learned to call mother, I represented to her all the dark thoughts which I had upon me about it, and told her what distress I was in. She seemed graver by much at this part than at the other, but as she was hardened in these things beyond all possibility of being touched with the religious part, and the scruples about the murder, so she was equally impenetrable in that part which related to affection. She asked me if she had not been careful and tender to me in my lying in, as if I had been her own child. I told her I owned she had. "Well, my dear," says she, "and when you are gone, what are you to me? And what would it be to me if you were to be hanged? Do you think there are not women who, as it is their trade and they get their bread by it, value themselves upon their being as careful of children as their own mothers can be, and understand it rather better?" "Yes, yes, child," says she, "fear it not. How were we nursed ourselves? Are you sure you was nursed up by your own mother? And yet you look fat and fair, child," says the old beldam. And with that she stroked me over the face. "Never be concerned, child," says she, going on in her drolling way. "I have no murderers about me. I employ the best and the honestest nurses that can be had, and have as few children miscarry under their hands as there would if they were all nursed by mothers. We want neither care nor skill." She touched me to the quick when she asked if I was sure that I was nursed by my own mother. On the contrary, I was sure I was not, and I trembled and looked pale at the very expression. "Sure," said I to myself, "this creature cannot be a witch, or have any conversation with a spirit that can inform her what was done with me before I was able to know it myself." And I looked at her as if I had been frightened. But reflecting that it could not be possible for her to know anything about me, that disorder went off, and I began to be easy. But it was not presently. She perceived the disorder I was in, but did not know the meaning of it. So she ran on in her wild talk about the weakness of my supposing that children were murdered because they were not all nursed by the mother, and to persuade me that the children she disposed of were as well used as if the mothers had the nursing of them themselves. "It may be true, mother," says I, "for aught I know, but my doubts are very strongly grounded indeed." "Come, then," says she, "let's hear some of them." "Why, first," says I, "you give a piece of money to these people to take the child off the parents' hands, and to take care of it as long as it lives." "Now we know, mother," said I, "that those are poor people, and their gain consists in being quit of the charge as soon as they can. How can I doubt but that, as it is best for them to have the child die, they are not over-solicitous about life?" "This is all vapours and fancy," says the old woman. "I tell you their credit depends upon the child's life, and they are as careful as any mother of you all." "Oh, mother," says I, "if I was but sure my little baby would be carefully looked to, and of justice done it, I should be happy indeed. But it is impossible I can be satisfied in that point, unless I saw it, and to see it would be ruin and destruction to me, as now my case stands. So what to do I know not. "A fine story," says the governess. "You would see the child, and you would not see the child. You would be concealed and discovered both together. These are the things impossible, my dear, so you must e'en do as other conscientious mothers have done before you, and be contented with things as they must be, though they are not as you wish them to be." I understood what she meant by conscientious mothers. She would have said conscientious whores, but she was not willing to disoblige me. For really, in this case, I was not a whore, because legally married, the force of former marriage excepted. However, let me be what I would, I was not come up to that pitch of hardness common to the profession. I mean, to be unnatural and regardless of the safety of my child. And I preserved this honest affection so long that I was upon the point of giving up my friend at the bank, who lay so hard at me to come to him and marry him, that, in short, there was hardly any room to deny him. At last my old governess came to me, with her usual assurance. "Come, my dear," says she, "I have found out a way how you shall be at a certainty that your child shall be used well, and yet the people that take care of it shall never know you, or who the mother of the child is." "Oh, mother," says I, "if you can do so, you will engage me to you forever." "Well," says she, "are you willing to be a some small annual expense? More than what we usually give to the people we contract with?" "Aye," says I, "with all my heart, provided I may be concealed." "As to that," says the governess, "you shall be secure, for the nurse shall never so much as dare to inquire about you, and you shall once or twice a year go with me and see your child, and see how 'tis used, and be satisfied that it is in good hands, nobody knowing who you are." "Why," said I, "do you think, mother, that when I come to see my child, I shall be able to conceal my being the mother of it? Do you think that possible?" "Well, well," says my governess, "if you discover it, the nurse shall be never the wiser, for she shall be forbid to ask any questions about you, or to take any notice. If she offers it, she shall lose the money which you are supposed to give her, and the child shall be taken from her too." I was very well pleased with this. So the next week a countrywoman was brought from Hertford, or thereabouts, who was to take the child off our hands entirely for 10 pounds in money. But if I would allow 5 pounds a year more of her, she would be obliged to bring the child to my governess's house as often as we desired, or we should come down and look at it, and see how well she used it. The woman was very wholesome-looking. A likely woman, a cottager's wife. But she had very good clothes and linen, and everything well about her. And, with a heavy heart and many a tear, I let her have my child. I had been down at Hertford, and looked at her and at her dwelling, which I liked well enough, and I promised her great things if she would be kind to the child. So she knew at first word that I was the child's mother. But she seemed to be so much out of the way, and to have no room to inquire after me, that I thought I was safe enough. So, in short, I consented to let her have the child. And I gave her 10 pounds, that is to say, I gave it to my governess, who gave it the poor woman before my face, she agreeing never to return the child back to me, or to claim anything more for its keeping or bringing up, only that I promised, if she took a great deal of care of it, I would give her something more as often as I came to see it, so that I was not bound to pay the 5 pounds, only that I promised my governess I would do it. And thus my great care was over, after a manner, which though it did not at all satisfy my mind, yet was the most convenient for me, as my affairs then stood, of any that could be thought of at that time. I then began to write to my friend at the bank, in a more kindly style, and particularly about the beginning of July 1st, sent him a letter that I proposed to be in town some time in August. He returned me an answer in the most passionate terms imaginable, and desired me to let him have timely notice, and he would come and meet me, 2 days' journey. This puzzled me scurvily, and I did not know what answer to make of it. Once I resolved to take the stagecoach to Westchester, on purpose only to have the satisfaction of coming back, that he might see me really come in the same coach, for I had a jealous thought, though I had no ground for it at all, lest he should think I was not really in the country, and it was no ill-grounded thought, as you shall hear presently. I endeavoured to reason myself out of it, but it was in vain. The impression lay so strong on my mind that it was not to be resisted. At last it came as an addition to my new design of going into the country, that it would be an excellent blind to my old governess, and would cover entirely all my other affairs, for she did not know in the least whether my new lover lived in London or in Lancashire, and when I told her my resolution, she was fully persuaded it was in Lancashire. Having taken my measure for this journey, I let her know it, and sent the maid that tended me, from the beginning, to take a place for me in the coach. She would have had me let the maid have waited on me down to the last stage, and come up again in the wagon, but I convinced her it would not be convenient. When I went away, she told me she would enter into no measures for correspondence, for she saw evidently that my affection to my child would cause me to write to her, and to visit her too when I came to town again. I assured her it would, and so took my leave, well satisfied to have been freed from such a house, however good my accommodations there had been, as I have related above. I took the place in the coach, not to its full extent, but to a place called Stone in Cheshire, I think it is, where I not only had no manner of business, but not so much as the least acquaintance with any person in the town or near it. But I knew that with money in the pocket, one is at home anywhere. So I lodged there 2 or 3 days, till, watching my opportunity, I found room in another stagecoach, and took passage back again for London, sending a letter to my gentleman that I should be such a certain day at Stony Stratford, where the coachman told me he was to lodge. It happened to be a chance coach that I had taken up, which, having been hired on purpose to carry some gentlemen to Westchester, who were going for Ireland, was now returning, and did not tie itself to exact times or places, as the stages did, so that, having been obliged to lie still on Sunday, he had time to get himself ready to come out, which otherwise he could not have done. However, his warning was so short that he could not reach to Stony Stratford time enough to be with me at night, but he met me at a place called Brick Hill the next morning, as we were just coming into tow. I confess I was very glad to see him, for I had thought myself a little disappointed overnight, seeing I had gone so far to contrive my coming on purpose. He pleased me doubly, too, by the figure he came in, for he brought a very handsome gentleman's coach and 4 horses, with a servant to attend him. He took me out of the stagecoach immediately, which stopped at an inn in Brickhill, and, putting into the same inn, he set up his own coach, and bespoke his dinner. I asked him what he meant by that, for I was going forward with the journey. He said no, I had need of a little rest upon the road, and that I was and that was a very good sort of house, though it was but a little town. So he would go no farther that night, whatever came of it. I did not press him much, for since he had come so to meet me, and put himself to so much expense, it was but reasonable I should oblige him a little too, so I was easy as to that point. After dinner, we walked to see the town, to see the church, and to view the fields and the country, as is usual for strangers to do, and our landlord was our guide in going to see the church. I observed my gentleman inquire pretty much about the parson, and I took the hint immediately that he certainly would propose to be married. And though it was a sudden thought, it followed presently that, in short, I would not refuse him. For, to be plain, with my circumstances I was in no condition now to say no. I had no reason now to run any more such hazards. But while these thoughts ran round in my head, which was the work but of a few moments, I observed my landlord took him aside and whispered to him, though not very softly neither, for so much I overheard.
"Sir, if you shall have occasion—"
The rest I could not hear. But it seems it was to this purpose.
"Sir, if you shall have occasion for a minister, I have a friend a little way off that will serve you, and be as private as you please."
My gentleman answered loud enough for me to hear,
"Very well, I believe I shall."
I was no sooner come back to the inn, but he fell upon me with irresistible words, that since he had had the good fortune to meet me, and everything concurred, it would be hastening his felicity if I would put an end to the matter just there. "What do you mean?" says I, colouring a little. "What, in an inn? And upon the road? Bless us all," said I, as if I had been surprised. "How can you talk so?"
"Oh, I can talk so very well," says he. "I come a purpose to talk so, and I'll show you that I did."
And with that he pulls out a great bundle of papers. "You fright me," said I. "What are all these?"
"Don't be frighted, my dear," said he, and kissed me.
This was the first time that he had been so free to call me "my dear." Then he repeated it.
"Don't be frighted. You shall see what it is all."
Then he laid them all abroad. There was first the deed or sentence of divorce from his wife, and the full evidence of her playing the whore. Then there were the certificates of the minister and church-wardens of the parish where she lived, proving that she was buried, and intimating the manner of her death, the copy of the coroner's warrant for a jury to sit upon her, and the verdict of the jury, who brought it in non compos mentis. All this was indeed to the purpose, and to give me satisfaction, though, by the way, I was not so scrupulous, had he known all, but that I might have taken him without it. However, I looked them all over as well as I could, and told him that this was all very clear indeed, but that he need not have given himself the trouble to have brought them out with him, for it was time enough. "Well," he said, "it might be time enough for me, but no time but the present time was time enough for him." There were other papers rolled up, and I asked him what they were.
"Why, aye," says he, "that's the question I wanted to have you ask me."
So he unrolls them and takes out a little shagreen case, and gives me out of it a very fine diamond ring. I could not refuse it, if I had a mind to do so, for he put it upon my finger. So I made him a curtsy and accepted it. Then he takes out another ring.
"And this," says he, "is for another occasion."
So he puts that in his pocket. "Well, but let me see it, though," says I, and smiled. "I guess what it is.
I think you are mad." "I should have been mad if I had done less," says he,
and still he did not show me, and I had a great mind to see it. So I says, "Well, but let me see it."
"Hold," says he, "first look here."
Then he took up the roll again and read it, and behold, it was a license for us to be married. "Why," says I, "are you distracted?" "Why,
You were fully satisfied that I would comply and yield at first word, or resolve to take no denial.
The last is certainly the case, said he.
But you may be mistaken, said I.
No, no, says he. How can you think so? I must not be denied. I can't be denied.
And with that he fell to kissing me so violently I could not get rid of him. There was a bed in the room, and we were walking to and again, eager in the discourse. At last he takes me by surprise in his arms, and threw me on the bed, and himself with me, and holding me fast in his arms, but without the least offer of any indecency, courted me to consent with such repeated entreaties and arguments, protesting his affection, and vowing he would not let go till I had promised him, that at last I said, Why, you resolve not to be denied.
Indeed, I can't be denied.
Well, well, said I, and giving him a slight kiss. Then you shan't be denied, said I. Let me get up. He was so transported with my consent, and the kind manner of it, that I began to think once he took it for a marriage, and would not stay for the form, but wronged him, for he gave over kissing me, and then giving me two or three kisses again, thanked me for my kind yielding to him, and was so overcome with the satisfaction and joy of it, that I saw tears stand in his eyes. I turned from him, for it filled my eyes with tears too, and I asked him to leave to retire a little to my chamber. If ever I had a grain of true repentance for a vicious and abominable life for 24 years past, it was then. Oh, what a felicity is it to mankind, said I to myself, that they cannot see into the hearts of one another. How happy had it been for me if I had been wife to a man so much honesty and so much affection from the beginning. Then it occurred to me, what an abominable creature am I, and how is this innocent gentleman going to be abused by me? How little does he think that having divorced a whore, he is throwing himself into the arms of another, that he is going to marry one that has lain with 2 brothers and has had 3 children by her own brother, one that was born in Newgate, whose mother was a whore, and is now a transported thief, one that has lain with 13 men, and has had a child since he saw me. Poor gentleman, said I, what is he going to do? After this reproaching myself was over, it following thus, Well, if I must be his wife, if it please God to give me grace, I'll be a true wife to him, and love him suitably to the strange excess of his passion for me. I will make him amends, if possible, by what he shall see, for the cheats and abuses I put upon him, which he does not see. He was impatient for my coming out of my chamber, but finding me long, he went downstairs and talked with my landlord about the parson. My landlord, an officious though well-meaning fellow, had sent away for the neighbouring clergyman, and when my gentleman began to speak of it to him, and talk of sending for him, Sir, says he to him, my friend is in the house. So, without any more words, he brought them together. When he came to the minister, he asked him if he would venture to marry a couple of strangers that were both willing. The parson said that Mr. had said something to him of it, that he hoped it was no clandestine business, that he seemed to be a grave gentleman, and he supposed Madam was not a girl, so that the consent of friends should be wanted. To put you out of doubt of that, says my gentleman, read this paper, and out he pulls the license. I am satisfied, says the minister. Where is the lady? You shall see her presently, says my gentleman. When he had said thus, he comes upstairs, and I was by that time come out of my room. So he tells me the minister was below, and that he had talked with him, and that upon showing him the license, he was free to marry us with all his heart. But he asked to see you. So he asked if I would let him come up. "'Tis time enough," said I. "In the morning, is it not?" "Why," said he, "my dear," he seemed to scruple whether it was not some young girl stolen from her parents, and I assured him we were both of age to command our own consent, and that made him ask to see you. "Well," said I, "do as you please." So up they brings the parson, and a merry good sort of gentleman he was. He had been told, it seems, that we had met there by accident, that I came in the Chester coach, and my gentleman in his own coach to meet me, that we were to have met last night at Stony Stratford, but that he could not reach so far. "Well, sir," says the parson, "every ill turn has some good in it. The disappointment, sir," says he to my gentleman, "was yours, and the good turn is mine, for if you had met at Stony Stratford, I had not had the honour to marry you. Landlord, have you a common prayer-book?" I started as if I had been frightened. "Lord, sir," says I, "what do you mean? What, to marry in an inn, and at night, too?"
"Madam,"
says the minister,
"if you will have it be in the church, you shall. But I assure you your marriage will be as firm here as in the church. We are not tied by the canons to marry nowhere but in the church, and if you will have it in the church, it will be as public as a county fair. And as for the time of day, it does not at all weigh in this case. Our princes are married in their chambers, and at 8 or 10 o'clock at night."
It was a great while before I could be persuaded, and pretended not to be willing at all to be married but in the church. But it was all grimace. So I seemed at last to be prevailed on, and my landlord and his wife and daughter were called up. My landlord was father and clerk and all together, and we were married, and very merry we were, though I confess the self-reproaches which I had upon me before lay close to me, and extorted every now and then a deep sigh from me, which my bridegroom took notice of, and endeavoured to encourage me, thinking, poor man, that I had some little hesitations at the step I had taken so hastily. We enjoyed ourselves that evening completely, and yet all was kept so private in the inn that not a servant in the house knew of it, for my landlady and her daughter waited on me, and would not let any of the maids come upstairs, except while we were at supper. My landlady's daughter I called my bridesmaid, and sending for a shopkeeper the next morning, I gave the young woman a good suit of knots, as good as the town would afford, and finding it was a lace-making town, I gave her mother a piece of bone lace for a head. One reason that my landlord was so close was that he was unwilling the minister of the parish should hear of it, but for all that somebody heard of it. So at that we had the bell set a-ringing the next morning early, and the music, such as the town would afford, under our window. But my landlord brazened it out, that we were married before we came thither, only that, being his former guests, we would have our wedding supper at his house. We could not find in our hearts to stir the next day, for, in short, having been disturbed by the bells in the morning, and having perhaps not slept over much before, we were so sleepy afterwards that we lay in bed till almost 12 o'clock. I begged my landlady that we might not have any more music in the town, nor ringing of bells, and she managed it so well that we were very quiet. But an odd passage interrupted all my mirth for a good while. The great room of the house looked into the street, and my new spouse being below stairs, I had walked to the end of the room, and it being a pleasant, warm day, I had opened the window, and was standing at it for some air, when I saw three gentlemen come by on horseback, and go into an inn just against us. It was not to be concealed. Nor was it so doubtful as to leave me any room to question it. But the second of the three was my Lancashire husband. I was frightened to death. I never was in such a consternation in my life. I thought I should have sunk into the ground. My blood ran chill in my veins, and I trembled as I had been in a cold fit of ague. I say, there was no room to question the truth of it. I knew his clothes. I knew his horse. And I knew his face. End of section 14. Recorded by Nicole Doolin on the web at nicoledoolin.com.